3, 2, 1. Welcome everybody to the Last Tech Podcast. My name is Eve and I'm so happy to have on the show today the co-founder and CEO of Stellate. Please welcome to the show Max Stoiber. Max, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited for this conversation today.
Yeah, me too. So Max, you've had this amazing career. You've created really popular open source projects. Spectrum was a company that was acquired by GitHub, right? Mm-hmm. And then you worked at Gatsby for a little bit, but now you're working at this amazing company, Stellate. Tell me a little bit more about how that all came to be.
How much time do you have? Can I keep going here for 2 hours?
No,
I'll give you the long and short version. I found my love for building products and building sort of things that people can use very early on in life. And so I ended up making a career out of really, first in the front-end world and then in the full-stack JavaScript, TypeScript world, building products, but also building lots of open-source projects like Style Components and React Boilerplate. I ended up joining the React community really early on back in 2015, maybe 16, shortly after its release. And as we all know, React was sort of an island without a lot of the stuff around it being released. And so the community had to step in and a lot of that stuff I ended up being a part of out of necessity because I loved React and I wanted to use it and I needed to close all those gaps. And through that, I ended up really loving the broader developer space. I worked on Spectrum, co-founded Spectrum, where we were building sort of a modern take on community forums for open source projects. That eventually got acquired by GitHub and turned into GitHub Discussions, which I'm sure many of you folks have used. Then worked at Gatsby because, again, love developer experience, love working on things that help people build faster and build better. And then now co-founded Stellate, and Stellate really came to be because at Spectrum we were using GraphQL for everything and loving it, and we were loving GraphQL. And we had huge scaling problems due to other parts of our stack. And as we grew, I realized if I can just put a cache in front of my API, that's going to solve a lot of our scaling problems because we have super public and super read-heavy traffic and data. And so that could alleviate a lot of the load, but nothing existed. And I looked at that problem and I went, that's kind of weird because GraphQL clients do this in the browser. Why can't somebody just do this either on the server or ideally at the CDN level, right? Especially the normalized caching, which is a lot of the powerfulness of GraphQL clients. But it didn't exist. And then, you know, later after GitHub acquired Spectrum and even 2 years or 2-3 years after that, nobody built it. And I was like, that's kind of ridiculous. And I met Tim, and Tim had actually built a prototype. My co-founder Tim had built a prototype of it. And I was like, we should turn this. We got to turn this into a product. Like, people are going to need this. And so for the last more than three years now at this point, we've really been in the GraphQL space, building first the edge caching and now expanding into GraphQL metrics and GraphQL security, just trying to help people sort of with problems that they might face by being in front of any GraphQL API that you can think of. That's really what we do.
Totally. So
that's really been a very short summary of my journey. There's lots of nuances and, you know, twists and turns, but that's the Instagram version of it. Instagram story version of my journey over the last years.
I love it. And yeah, I think as you said, GraphQL is so, those are the perennial questions that people have when they're actually rolling it out, right? It's like caching, security, metrics. How do we look at how this GraphQL API is actually working? So I know that you're just making everyone's lives way easier. So that's really cool. So you chose GraphQL as a technology after using it and feeling like it was a great thing. And we've been around in the GraphQL trenches for a long time. And I think from my perspective, correct me if I'm wrong, it started out, all these React developers loved it. It was this thing that everyone needed and wanted so much. And then it seems like the user of a GraphQL app has changed a lot from this like front-end person who's trying to load data into their components to someone trying to really wrangle data for the back end. So how do you think that GraphQL, the perception of GraphQL has changed over time?
That's a great question. I think GraphQL was released back in 2015, 16 as well. I want to say it's like almost 10 years old at this point. And yeah. Facebook really invented it because they needed a central intermediary layer between their many, many clients, right? Their mobile apps, their web apps, their TV apps, their whatever other apps they have. And there are many, many microservices and data sources in the back end. And they sort of invented this new language and this new tool chain so that they could work across all these different microservices written in different languages, sort of connect them all together into a central schema and centralized data access plane. And then they released it, and in classic Facebook open source style, they just released it and gave it to people and didn't say much about it. They sort of gave a talk and then let everybody just do whatever they wanted. And inevitably, people looked at it. And at the time, back in 2015, 2016, even though that might seem a little bit ridiculous now, it was almost the only way to build a fully type-safe API with Flow or TypeScript back then. Like there was no tRPC, there was no, you know, full React, never mind React Server components. There was no way to access data in a type-safe way. And so GraphQL enabled that. And so lots of people adopted it for that reason, because they were like, oh, I finally can build a type-safe API. But for just building a type-safe API, it's a pretty heavy solution. Like, it's a whole new language, it's a whole new tool chain, you need a whole new client, a whole new server. It requires you to rethink how you access data. Like, it's a really pretty heavy thing for just getting types for an API, right? Or even if you're in React Server Components world now, just getting types from a database queries, right? Like, that is a whole new layer that you're introducing to solve a much simpler problem. And so over time, as people realized, oh, actually GraphQL is kind of heavy, and it's kind of complicated, and really, I just want types from an API. Better solutions for that emerged, right? tRPC came out, now React Server Components are sort of there, and they're likely going to simplify a lot of those use cases even further. And really, that problem of I want sort of type-safe data access on the clients got solved in much simpler ways, and rightfully so, because GraphQL is a very heavy solution for that. But funnily enough, I think through that, GraphQL sort of got a bad rep because people tried it and they were like, "Oh, it's so heavy, so I'm never gonna touch it." Right? Like, it's a heavy solution. It's not at all what I needed. I really wanted something else, and so I'm never gonna go touch it again. But interestingly, when you think about the problems that GraphQL solves, which we can also talk about, there really is no other solution, right? Once you are at a scale where you run into these problems, where you have many engineers, many microservices, many clients, what are you going to do? Like, you can build a REST API, right? And you can add an open API spec to it, but you're going to run into overfetching, you're going to run into performance problems, you're going to run into maintenance problems. You can build BFFs, but then you have duplication across the board, you end up having huge maintenance issues across all these different companies that have tried it. GraphQL is honestly the only solution that actually solves the problems. And so that's why at the enterprise scale, right, when you're talking to these really large organizations that have many, many hundreds or thousands of engineers, GraphQL's finding a ton of adoption because there's no other option, right? And so over the last 3 years, GraphQL has gone from, I don't know, 10% of the Fortune 500 to like 30%, I think. And they're estimating that it's going to be 70% in another few years because there is no other, like, you literally don't have a choice. Either you have a bad data access setup or you use GraphQL. Those are your two options. And of course, people then end up choosing GraphQL. But the popular perception hasn't kept up with that reality, right? And so when you talk to all these indie hackers and startup people and sort of, you know, early stage developers, they look at GraphQL and they go, oh, that was such a heavy solution. That's like 10 years old. Yeah, I don't care about it anymore. You know, like that's old. I don't need it. And it's true. They don't need it. Yeah. But then inferring from that other people don't need it, I think is the mistake that many people make. That's sort of unfortunate because eventually they end up shooting themselves in the foot by not using it once they are working at a company that is at that scale. And so I think I'm hoping that we can sort of shift the discourse a little bit from GraphQL is a heavy solution for getting types of data access on the client to, hey, what actually is GraphQL needed for, right? Who actually is adopting GraphQL today and why are they adopting it? Coming with that curiosity. Is really what I'm trying to go for. So I hope, listeners, if you're working at a company that's running into sort of scaling problems, consider GraphQL. It will solve a lot of those for you.
Yeah, so you alluded, I couldn't agree more, by the way, but you alluded to this a little bit. What are the types of problems that people find themselves running into after they get past the startup phase where they might think this is too much right now, but then they're like, oh no, we actually do need this?
Yeah. I think what's interesting about GraphQL, before I talk about the specific problems that we hear about pretty frequently, what's interesting about GraphQL is that it doesn't obviously solve all these problems. Many of them just kind of disappear, right? Once you start using GraphQL, because it completely changes the way you access data, a lot of these problems aren't necessarily solved in a very direct way. They just kind of don't exist anymore. Like, they're no longer problems that you have to deal with because it just works very differently. And so that solved them, but it's sort of hard to realize because you have to have been there before in order to understand that it solved the problems that just kind of quietly disappeared after you started using GraphQL. And I think also for context, a lot of this is informed from having just spoken with hundreds, maybe thousands of companies at this point about their APIs, and especially ones using GraphQL, right? That's part of, big part of my job is talking to all these companies. And so I've recently been trying to sort of discern what are the patterns between all these companies that have adopted GraphQL to solve their problems or have, make them go away, and what are those problems? And I've sort of landed on four first framings that I think are threads that we've heard of quite frequently. The first one is around mobile apps. Often companies complain about mobile apps breaking after API changes because GraphQL only returns the fields that the clients explicitly request. You can add new capabilities by adding new fields or types, right? And it does not ever impact existing clients. Existing clients keep working the exact same way. You never have to worry about breaking them or making them really unperforming because you keep adding data to a JSON endpoint and the client's just fetching all of it. And so over time, you end up with a huge performance problem, right? You don't run into any of those issues. And you can monitor, because the client specifies exactly here are the fields that I need, you can monitor which fields the client actually uses. And so if there's something that's either unused or that's still used, that's been deprecated, you can go talk to that client and you can be like, hey, iOS team, you're still using this field that we deprecated a year and a half ago that we're trying to replace with this other field. Can you please migrate over? Or you can even write a code note to do the migration for them, right? Like a lot of that stuff just isn't possible with any other API. And so often companies talk about, hey, our mobile apps break every now and then because of API changes and we want to prevent that. We want to make the changes safer to make is a common thread that we hear with companies wanting to adopt GraphQL.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think that insight wasn't always there either. So the ability to actually see the metrics for particular fields and see, hey, this actually old client is trying to grab this wrong field. And I think we have so much better GraphQL tooling today than we ever did. So have you seen that totally as well?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, GraphQL tooling, particularly in the last few years, has evolved dramatically and gotten much, much better and much, much simpler. It's also interesting because I think a lot of people sort of miss, well, if you haven't experienced these problems before, it's sort of hard to visualize what they're like, right? And so recently when I talked about this, somebody responded to me and was like, well, Max, but in my REST API, I can also just add a new field, right? And it's like, yeah, you can, but the client doesn't specify which fields it actually uses, right? So then you're just fetching everything and your client has to load download all this data. And so if you multiply that by every single change that you're making, you end up having, you know, JSON endpoints that return 1,000 keys, each with a nested object within them, and you're fetching megabytes of data, and suddenly your mobile app is really slow and everybody complains about it, right? And so this is one of those things where GraphQL doesn't directly solve this problem, right? Nobody would advertise GraphQL as like, hey, your mobile app's breaking, go use GraphQL. You know, it's not a very direct solution to the problem, but because GraphQL works so differently, where the client has to select the fields that it actually uses, you end up not running into any maintenance issues over time as you evolve. And so it's a great example of a problem that just kind of goes away because GraphQL works very differently, but not necessarily one that it solves very explicitly. You know, like you're never going to go to GraphQL.com and you're going to see, or GraphQL.org and you're going to see, you know, your mobile apps are breaking, go use GraphQL, right? That doesn't make any sense. That connection isn't there. Another common one that I've just alluded to also that people talk about is just slow performance, right? Slow loading times, because with traditional REST APIs, you end up having request waterfalls or you end up overfetching significantly, right? You sort of, famously, Facebook, and that's one of the big reasons why they invented GraphQL in the first place, is because their client, if you loaded the feed page, had to make 30 nested waterfall requests. And the problem with making that from the client is that you're always incurring the additional network latency of going from the client to the origin, right? And particularly when you're a global company, that can have really large impact if you have users elsewhere from pretty far away from your data centers. People solve this problem. Other companies have solved this problem with BFFs, like SoundCloud very famously used the BFF pattern. Funnily enough, SoundCloud has now actually switched to GraphQL because it turns out when you do BFFs, which is backend for frontends, where you have sort of a dedicated service that has, you know, view specific endpoints, where you have slash get events page and that returns just exactly the data that the events page needs, that solves the request waterfalls and the overfetching because you're only returning the data that client actually needs. But you're introducing immense duplication because you need one of those endpoints for each page on each client. And so you just end up having, the companies that use this pattern end up having hundreds, if not thousands of endpoints, and it becomes a maintenance issue because if you just try to make a change or you try to enforce a new performance SLA or a new security thing, it ends up being a nightmare for any changes that you make. And so performance is often one that people now solve with GraphQL because, again, you don't really have a different solution. Like you can go with BFFs, but then you're just introducing other problems that you didn't have before. So that's another common problem that we hear about.
Totally. Yeah, I think that speaks to the communication help that GraphQL gives you to among the team, the schema, the insights to like what is actually in this API is such a tricky thing, I feel like, with REST APIs. No matter how great your REST documentation is, it feels like GraphQL is a little, you have better visibility into what those actual fields actually are. So I feel like that helps a lot too.
Totally. I totally agree. And in fact, that's another one of the common problems that we hear about is sort of like, I don't know which endpoints even exist and where to get the data that I need from my REST API, because I have hundreds of REST endpoints and I don't have visibility into what gets returned from where. And again, this is one of those problems that just kind of goes away with GraphQL, because with GraphQL, you have to have a schema. And I think people in the REST world don't understand, in order for you to return any piece of data, it has to be in the schema. You cannot return data that isn't in the schema. And so then inherently, discovery is not an issue anymore, because all of the data has to be in the central schema and you can find it in GraphQL. But it doesn't, again, you wouldn't go to graphql.org and expect there to be a tagline that's like, oh, you can't find your REST endpoints, go use GraphQL. Again, it doesn't make any, the problem just kind of goes away inherently because of how GraphQL works. It just has that central schema. It has that central definition of what data exists and how to access it. And that solves that entire class of problems, just kind of goes away, right? You never have to worry about discovery, which is sort of a bit of a misnomer too, because you know, at some scale, if you have hundreds of thousands of types in your schema, then yes, true, you will also have a hard time finding what you're looking for, but then you just have a large data model and it's just inherent to your data model. But fundamentally, GraphQL solves that problem for a lot of companies because it just enforces the usage of a central schema, right? And so you don't have to worry about the discovery or the maintenance of it, right? The other part too is because GraphQL has this field selection thing, any update that you make to any type, like say you change the way that you store users, you only have to update one database query in your user object type, and nothing else has to worry about this underlying change, right? Everything else stays the same because GraphQL is another layer that abstracts between your database and your clients, where often if you have REST APIs and they sort of just pass through what the database returns, suddenly you end up having maintenance issues up and down the stack. Whenever you make a change, you suddenly have to propagate that change all the way through front to back, and that's being really, really painful. Yeah, and then just to close off the loop here, the fourth issue that we hear, or the fourth problem that we hear a lot about that goes away with GraphQL is security and performance often, and specifically keeping on top of them. Because GraphQL is a central data access layer, you can enforce security and performance at a very fine-grained level and sort of distribute responsibility between the teams that are actually responsible for it. And one of the things actually that I'm, this is a story that sits with me really very strongly, which is we were using GraphQL at Spectrum. And we were, you know, three co-founders, essentially for a year and a half, sitting in our bedrooms, hacking away at product and just trying to ship as fast as possible, trying to figure out what do people need. And then once we found what people needed, making it better and sort of shipping all the improvements that people wanted. And in that world, we didn't pay particularly much attention to security. Now, I don't want to say that we weren't mindful of security broadly, but it's not like, you know, we're a three-person startup. We didn't have a security team. We didn't have a security posture. We didn't have SOC 2. None of those things really had crossed our mind yet. Yeah. Now, when GitHub acquired us, because they acquired the IP and the company, they essentially take on, whenever a company gets acquired, you take on the liability of that company, right? So say GitHub acquired Spectrum and then Spectrum had a major security issue, GitHub would be on the hook for that security issue. And so whenever companies acquire other companies, they do security checks, and GitHub paid 8 pen testers in one of the world's best pen testing agencies to try and hack Spectrum for an entire week. And I was scared shitless that whole week because, we had spent zero time explicitly thinking about security, right? And we knew that this could make or break the deal. If that was a major security hole that we couldn't close very quickly, then GitHub wouldn't buy us because they wouldn't want to take on that liability. And I'm extremely proud to say that they came back and they had not found a single major security vulnerability. And in fact, they only found one medium one that was sort of a bit of bullshit, but whatever. And I largely actually credit GraphQL for that. Because we were using GraphQL as our central data access layer, the only thing we had done from a security perspective, outside of course, two-factor authentication and all that general stuff, was we just had one access control check in every resolver, right? And so when you tried to create a channel, for example, we had an access control check that just made sure that you were an admin or a moderator of the overlying community. When you tried to create the thread, we tried to make sure that you're a member in the community and you had permission to do so. So every resolver had an access control check. And even though not all of those access control checks were perfect, like there was some things where like you could change the description of a community when you were the moderator of a sub-channel, even if you weren't a moderator of the community, not all of them were 100% perfect, but they were good enough to where there were no major security issues in any of those access control checks. And so then broadly, because that was the only plane where you could actually access the data that we had, we didn't have any major security issues, right? Because nothing else really mattered. And so that really showed to me the power of having the central layer. Yes, it's an additional abstraction that can be heavy for simple use cases, but it also just removes all these problems entirely. You never have to think about security. Where with REST APIs, I've seen some REST APIs where people just do random database queries in random endpoints and then return some data, and there is very little guarantee that any of it is secure or has the right access control checks. And so that's another one of the big problems that just kind of disappears when you're using GraphQL. Not because, you know, again, there won't ever be a tagline on GraphQL.org that's like, you have security issues, go use GraphQL. That doesn't make any sense, right? But when you use GraphQL, because of the way it works, that class of security issues just disappears. Like, you just never really have to worry about it. It's just not a thing anymore. And so that's another one of the big problems that we hear about. So just to summarize, so that people can sort of keep track, the four problems that we hear about the most when people talk about adopting GraphQL are mobile apps breaking after API changes. It's really slow loading times because of request waterfalls or overfetching. It's sort of this difficult maintenance and discovery because you have these many, many, many REST endpoints and you don't know what data is where. And then security and performance being this game of whack-a-mole to enforce as you're sort of growing and trying to keep everything secure and performant.
Yeah, I love that breakdown, and I also love that story, even though I'm sure that was the most stressful week ever to have that going on. But I love the outcome of that because, yeah, I feel like misconception I hear so often about GraphQL is, oh, we're just going to open up all of our data to a query that's going to take down our whole API. It's going to, what if we have these malicious actors? But I do feel like having one extra layer in there that manages security actually has the opposite effect, where it really helps to secure the data source much, much better. So when you think about security at Stellate, what are some of the things that you have in mind? I know that you have the SOC 2 and all of those. It's a very compelling reason to use GraphQL.
Yeah. The way we think about all the products that we build at Stellate is that we've built a team of GraphQL experts, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we have maintainers of some of the most popular GraphQL clients of GraphQL. We have the person that architected the Contentful GraphQL API. Like, we have all these people that love GraphQL, obviously, because who goes to work at a GraphQL company, somebody that loves GraphQL, right? Like, inherently, we were bound to attract those people. And so we try to build products that take advantage of our expertise and experience with GraphQL to provide value that otherwise wouldn't be possible, right? And that applies through our whole product suite. And so, for example, our API caching that we do for GraphQL, you could look at it and you could go, cool, it's GraphQL edge caching, makes sense, right? Like, you can cache an API at the edge. But truthfully, because GraphQL is field selection, we can actually build better API caching based on GraphQL than you could for any other API, because we can do something called partial query caching, where even if only a part of the query is cacheable, we can extract that part if we have the data in the cache and only send the rest of the query to the origin to fetch the data that we need, right? And so you can significantly reduce load on the origin infrastructure by caching a lot more data than you could with any other API cache, right? And so, yes, it's a GraphQL edge cache. It only works for GraphQL. And because of how GraphQL works, it's actually more powerful than any other API cache on the planet, right? Enabled by GraphQL. And the same thing is true for our security products. We've built sort of three main things on the security front. One is very general security filters, because GraphQL is very flexible on purpose, there are some ways that malicious actors can abuse that flexibility to try and DDoS your systems. They can make really deeply nested queries. They can use lots of aliases to fetch a lot of repetitive data. They can try and figure out what your schema is like through error handling and sort of like the suggestions that come back. And so we've shipped some basic security filters to protect against these common GraphQL vulnerabilities that people try to abuse. Then we shipped rate limiting. So we now do sort of rate limiting that understands GraphQL. And so you can, on a per type or field level, you can be like, hey, I don't want the add to cart mutation to be called more than 3 times in 10 seconds, because otherwise I'm pretty sure that's a bot that's hammering the button and trying to buy the shoe that we dropped, right? And then also we shipped persisted operations, which is a way of sort of allow listing only the queries and mutations that your client actually sends itself. And so no malicious actor can send any others. But again, all of these solutions, they're very GraphQL specific, right? You couldn't take them and apply them to anything else because that doesn't make any sense, right? Persistent operations, security filters, those things only make sense in the context of GraphQL and to take advantage of GraphQL's unique nature to provide value. And so that's generally how we think about building products, is where, as a CDN that sits in front of GraphQL APIs, where can we take the experience and the expertise that we have with GraphQL and apply it to provide value to companies in ways that otherwise might or might not be possible for other APIs?
Yeah. That's so cool and so so important too. I feel like there's so many so many misconceptions that you're just getting rid of, so this is really awesome. I was able to meet a few of your team members at GraphQL Summit, and they all had something in common, which they all seemed very happy with their job. They seemed really stoked to be there, and that was really cool. I think it's a really big deal. So What do you think makes Stellate a great place to work? And aside from just being a GraphQL expert or someone interested in GraphQL, what do you look for when you hire folks?
This feels like a whole other podcast. Also, I don't know whether I'm the right person to ask
because
I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum. But I will say how I think about building an organization and a team, which I think will give you some color on that.
Yeah.
I think broadly speaking, Tim and I started Stellate with this belief that in order to be successful, we need to hire the best people and then put them in an environment where they can do their best work, right? And through that, we will find success much more likely than if we didn't do that. And so from the get-go, we knew we needed to invest in our people. We knew we needed to invest in our team building. We knew we needed to invest into connections between people. And so that culture permeates through our entire organization. We have four core values, and one of them is win as one team. And we really try to work together to win as a company, whatever that means. And we do all kinds of little and big things, like we have bi-weekly connection meetings where we just hang out and play games. We go do offsites at least 3 times a year. We fly the whole team out to conferences every now and then, like GraphQL Summit, to go and hang out and meet the ecosystem. We encourage people to, we have a perk where people can fly to visit a coworker a few times a year. There's lots of big and small things, but they all fundamentally, I can tell you all the little small things, but they all fundamentally flow from this belief that we want to hire the best people and then we want to put them in a really, really good environment. And so to us, that environment is one of trust and one of connection. And so that's a lot of what we're optimizing for and what we do. And actually, huge credit to Sue Odio, who joined us very early on as our head of people and operations and then later our COO, who drove a lot of these initiatives. Again, we knew we wanted to do this, but Tim and I had never built an organization before. And so we knew we needed to hire somebody to manage all of that. And so Sue was instrumental in building up that culture and that organization and building a team to where we have, even as an early stage startup that's only 3 years old and is still, you know, iterating and learning quickly and changing every month, we've had very little voluntary attrition. Meaning very few people have ever left that joined, and generally people report being very happy on their service. So, you know, things can always change, but fundamentally, it all flows from this belief that we're all adults. We're not a family, but we're more like a sports team, and we want to treat people with the respect that they deserve, right? Everybody's an adult, everybody does great work. Let's go work together and figure it out. And a big part of that is being connected and understanding each other and sort of working within the diversity that we have in the team. Lots of little things that all flow from one big belief is the answer.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think that really that really showed through to me. And I also saw that handbook on your website and how detailed that is for just folks joining the team and things. And I think that's so useful to, I don't know, just articulate that. And I'm sure, that flows down to everybody on your team. So I love it. Sorry to go off of GraphQL topics, but
that was
important because you have a really cool company. So, yeah,
the interesting learnings that I've had as a founder and as building my own team is that inherently the team that you build is sort of a mirror image of yourself, but a mirror image in a very direct way that I think can be ugly and can be pretty depending on which parts of your mirror image match what your organization needs and what it doesn't. And so even now I have a lot of respect for people that are, you know, a bit maybe controversial in some industries, right? Like Travis Kalanick, who founded Uber, right? Uber very famously had a very bro-y culture, very aggressive. After Derek came in and took over as CEO, he had to do a lot of cultural cleanup. But truthfully, Travis knew that he was a bro. Travis knew that he was a bit of an asshole and an aggressive asshole at that. And he found the market where the only way to win was to build a company in a culture like that. And he ended up winning because they had a culture like that at the beginning. And eventually that doesn't work anymore. But for the early stages, that was exactly what Uber needed in order to win. They needed to ignore regulators. They needed to ignore laws. They needed to cause trouble because that was the only way they were ever going to win in that market. And so you can look at that and you can go, Travis Kalanick is an asshole. You know, like Uber sucks. And yeah, that environment definitely wasn't for everybody, but I'm having never met the guy, I'm 100% certain that Travis knew exactly who he was, and he was like, I found the market where that is awesome and it's going to help us win, I'm going to go into that market. And that requires an immense level of self-acceptance and self-understanding that many people don't have. And one of the interesting parts of being a founder is you found this organization, and then 2 years in, I looked at around at one of our offices, and I was like, holy, I see myself in this organization everywhere. All the good things, which is awesome, but also all the bad things, which is less awesome, right? Because nobody's perfect, and not every way that you are as a human being matches what the organization needs in order to be successful. And so a lot of the journey of being a founder for me has also been just working on myself, being better at understanding who even am I, why am I acting this way, and why is the organization acting this way, and then how can I change myself, which is always difficult. And so that's just been a very interesting journey that I reflect on sometimes, in case anybody out there is thinking about building a company. The main thing you're going to be doing if you're successful is working on yourself more so than anything else.
Yeah, that's so well put. Working on yourself then translates to affecting everyone else. I feel like that's really true. And part of what I saw in that handbook was coaching too, how that's a big part of the benefits that you give folks, but also I'm sure benefits the organization as a whole too. So yeah, how does that fit into what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, again, right, like we're all really good at what we do and we all want to be better at what we do is sort of the core tenet of our values. And so we provide a coach of people's choice to every single employee, and they can work with that coach to get better at whatever it is that they're working on, right? That might be something very work-related, like, oh, I have this project that's not moving forward. How can I move it forward? But it can also be much more personal, much more like, hey, I grew up in a way where now I'm struggle with giving constructive feedback. How can I iterate on myself to get better at giving constructive feedback, get more comfortable with it, right? And that's helped the organization as a whole level up significantly. And also for me personally, has made a big impact, but also everybody that takes advantage of that perk really benefits, reports benefiting from it and says, hey, look, you know, and again, this goes back to, we just treat people like humans. Like, hey, you're here to do the job. We want you to do your job better every day than you did the day before. We'll pay for a coach so that you can do that, right? And that you can get better at what you do and you can be even more effective at selling. And yeah, some of it's sort of altruistic, right? Some of it's like, yeah, we want you to be a better human. And all of it is like, this is how we believe we will win as an organization, right? Yeah. We believe we will win because we have great people and because they keep getting better over time. And this is one of the ways that we think about accelerating that getting better over time.
Totally. I think that's so cool. And I think confidence is a thing that everyone needs to make a successful company happen, but also the vulnerability to say, hey, there's room for improvement in these areas. And yeah, I think that is not always the case when companies are starting out or 3 years in like you. So it's really cool. So the last thing I wanted to ask you about today was, you have this murderer's row of companies that you've invested in: Fly.io, Clerk, Zed, LiveBlocks, many, many, many others. So when you're investing in companies, and I'm sure this is colored by your experience as a founder, multi-hyphenate before, but how do you, I'm going to try that question again. What do you look for in a company as an investor?
So I started doing investment really out of a longing to learn, because I realized that every startup's journey is very unique, but also every startup's journey has very many ups and downs, every single one. Even if you're looking at the very successful companies that are just, you know, rocket ships going through the air, that graph that goes up and to the right is actually, there's lots of ups and downs every single day that just happen to get bigger and bigger over time. And so investing was a way for me to stay grounded a little bit, because often when you're founding your own startup, you're so heads down working on your own thing that every single up and every single down affects you very strongly. And then if you look at other startups and you sort of get these investor updates and you talk to these founders, they're struggling with ups and downs every day too, right? It sort of relativizes what you do, because you're like, if it's going really well, you're like, ah, well, I know it's going to get shitty again at some point. Like, I'm not going to be disillusioned from this high right now. Nor if it goes really badly, I look at that and I go, well, it sucks right now, but I know it's going to get better again, right? Like, this just happens to be a low that happened, and now we just got to deal with it and make it better. Yeah. The way I invest has changed over time. I'm really focused on companies where I feel like I have a unique understanding of the market or the situation, or it's something that I would use because I have a unique perspective, right? As a software engineer that's founded my own company that has now run through this process of building up a whole enterprise go-to-market motion, I understand many things that many people don't, and definitely not in this detail. And so then looking at that and going, hey, I might have an edge in this investing game through having this understanding that many other people don't. And so I invest in companies like Incident.io and Fly.io and Zed.dev and whatever, where I see something unique that I think the market broadly doesn't understand yet and hopefully will understand at some point. Or even better, it's something that I use myself that I love, like Raycast. I'm a huge Raycast user, and so I'm a proud investor there as well. Like, that's sort of generally how I invest in them. the main thing that matters to me is really the people, right? The founders are the founders that I think could build a really, really big company. I will also say now with how the market has shifted around IPOs and acquisitions where effectively they aren't happening, the bar for success has gotten so much higher that investing as a whole, I think, will have to be redefined a little bit, because it's going to be very difficult to say whether or not anybody's going to be able to have any return. Not even me, right? Like I've written off that money a long time ago. I really just invest for fun. But a lot of these professional investors that have funds, I'm very curious to see what's going to happen over the next couple of years as this develops, because I don't know how they're going to get their returns, right? In order for a company to IPO, it's now so much harder than it used to be in the past that way fewer companies are going to IPO, and even then they're going to IPO at lower valuations, even if they IPO. And so the whole math of that business, I don't know if it still works. I don't know how investors are thinking about this, but
yeah.
Very, very curious to see what's going to happen over the next few years with the startup ecosystem. I'm very fortunate to be in the position that I am right now, and I'm very curious to stay on top of that more.
Yeah, me too. I'm super interested. We had a really big run of just free money everywhere, and now it seems a little bit, the calculus has changed a little bit. So very cool. Well, Max, I won't take up too much more of your time. Is there anything that you want to plug before we sign off today?
I just want to say, like, if you're a company that faces one of the problems that I was talking about that GraphQL solves, or using GraphQL today, I would love to chat with you. If you have a problem that our product solves, or if you have a problem that you think GraphQL solves, I would love to talk to you. I'm always open to give advice from all these conversations that I've had based on your situation. Explore whether or not that actually makes sense for you. Just reach out, max@stellate.co. Email me anytime. Happy to hop on a call and just chat. I don't have to sell you anything. All I ask for in return is that you answer my questions and I get to learn more about what problems you run into and how you've thought about solving them in the past. That's really all I'm hoping to get out of it.
I love it. That's an extremely good offer. Max is one of the smartest people out there and one of the OGs of GraphQL, so take him up on that for sure. And yeah, I think check out that article. You probably don't need GraphQL. I've read it many times and it started a little bit of a Twitter X firestorm about GraphQL in general. And it's a really interesting, I feel like, transitional moment, but GraphQL is here to stay for sure. And I see it all the time how beneficial it is, especially for really huge companies who the data problems that they're facing are not insignificant. And as you said, it really just, it doesn't advertise that it solves all of these problems, but does. So I love that you're helping the communication around GraphQL too, because I think it's super important. So anyway, thank you so much, Max, for being here today. I think you're one of the smartest, coolest people out there, and it's been really fun chatting. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This was awesome.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much for joining the Last Tech Podcast. We'll see you next time.
The Last Tech Podcast.